The Inheritance is a new book by Pittsburgh-based writer Nikki Capsimbellis. It tells the story of the DeMoe family from North Dakota. They carry a rare genetic mutation that guarantees they'll get Alzheimer's disease at a young age. The DeMoes have been integral to strides made in Alzheimer's research over the past several decades, including advances made here at the University of Pittsburgh. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed speaks with Capsimbellis and with Dr. William Klunk, co-director of Pitt's Alzheimer's Research Center. Klunk is credited with helping to develop a method for imaging Alzheimer's in the living brain, something that wasn't possible before his team's discovery in 2002.
Nikki, I want to start with you. Tell me about the first time you met the DeMoe family. You were just planning on writing one news article about them, is that right?
Yeah, I met them in April 2009, and I actually was hired by Dr. Klunk's group to write an article about them for a newsletter for the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Pitt.
And so what struck you about this family? What made you follow them for then years, I guess?
They are a really remarkable bunch. They're unique in their approach to life, very humble, funny, down-to-earth people. They really make you feel at home. But what they're doing is so extraordinary in contrast to that, that it just drew me to them immediately. And they have that effect on almost everybody they meet, actually.
And so in terms of what made them appropriate for the study and for Alzheimer's research in general, can you talk about the mutation that they had?
Yeah, the family has a mutation that gives them early onset Alzheimer's, and it's a little bit different from what we think of in the general population. If you have this mutation, you're guaranteed to get it, and you are, I believe, pretty much guaranteed to get it young. They typically develop symptoms in their 40s, and they pass away in their 50s. And then they also have a 50% chance of passing it on to their children, which they found out after they already had children.
And so, Dr. Klunk, what then makes someone with this mutation good for doing research?
Well, you know from the moment you get the test results what the future will be for that person. So there's the goal for Alzheimer's research over the past decade was to push intervention earlier and earlier. So we look for biomarkers of the disease earlier and earlier before the typical symptoms are present. But if you do this in the general population, you don't know if you're doing it in someone destined to get the disease or someone not. So you don't know what your findings mean at that time. And these people, you know who's going to get the disease, as Nikki said, and who's not. So you can compare them directly and you have a much better way to interpret the results you get.
And so what was your aim, and I guess what is your aim in the research you're doing here?
Our aim has always been exactly that, understand the disease's earliest stages, well before anybody would expect someone to have Alzheimer's disease. You know, I think what we most of us think of now as early Alzheimer's disease will one day see equivalent to what we think of as metastatic cancer now, a very late stage of the disease. The disease has been present in your body for over a decade, and it's ravaged your brain in a way that it's unlikely we're going to be able to fix at that stage. But if we get it earlier and earlier, which is the theme in most of healthcare, you know, early intervention, early detection, be that colon cancer, breast cancer, heart disease, what have you, I think Alzheimer's disease will be in that same theme. If we can detect it before anybody shows symptoms, that's our best chance of providing effective treatment.
And prevention, potentially?
Well, that's what we're talking about, is prevention.
Nikki, I'm going to ask you to read this portion on page 102.
In 2008, for their discovery of PIB, Klunk and Mathis were awarded the American Academy of Neurology's Potemkin Prize, which is nicknamed the Nobel Prize of Neurology, and recognizes achievements in research for PICs, Alzheimer's, and related diseases. Bill always says, "We got really lucky," says Mathis. I say, "No, Bill, we didn't get lucky. We were due success." Pondering that thought, Klunk finally agreed. To a scientist, serial disappointment is the price of admission for a moment of great discovery. In other words, to triumph, you've got to fail, said Klunk.
So first, tell me, who is Mathis, and what made you think that you just got lucky?
Well, you do need to get lucky along the way. There are many scientists who have lots of great ideas. that don't pan out. I think some of my best ideas didn't pan out. Just because it pans out doesn't mean it was your greatest idea. Chet Mathis is my close colleague and co-inventor of PIB. He came to the University of Pittsburgh in 1994, and shortly after that, one of our senior leaders here, knowing what I did, suggested I go talk with him. And he was very eager to collaborate because, unbeknownst to me at the time, he had been trying to do the same thing pretty much about the same time I started when he was at UC Berkeley. And had taken a similar but significantly different path that didn't work out. And he set it aside then and went on with other research, whereas I kept banging my head against the wall here. But it was really, I think, Chet's coming that took it to the next level of, you know, bringing this idea into human research.
What is Pittsburgh Compound B, or PIB, and why were you so adamant about plugging away at this problem despite the fact that you weren't able to publish as often as, you know, some people think a researcher should?
Yeah, this is an area that, you know, you can publish along the way, but not like in many areas of research. You sort of have to wait until you get where you say you're going. Along the way, you know, I believed it was important. It just seemed like a basic self-inherent truth that being able to see a disease in a living person was better than having to wait until someone had died to see that disease. And that's where we were. You know, it was intellectually very fulfilling to me, the process along the way. I always tell young scientists, if you don't enjoy the day-to-day grind of what you're doing, the rewards, even the big ones, are so few and far between, they won't sustain you. So you have to enjoy the day-to-day things. And I did both that, but I also knew, and Chet shared the view, that this was important, and so did several other key people, and that's why we kept going.
So what is Pittsburgh Compound B?
Pittsburgh Compound B was actually named by our collaborators at the University of Uppsala in Sweden. They name their compounds from where they come from and then go alphabetically. And Pittsburgh Compound B was actually the second compound we sent them. So that's where Pittsburgh Compound B came from. What it is it's a derivative of the dyes that pathologists had used for decades to look at Alzheimer's disease at autopsy in the postmortem brain after death. So our simple-minded approach then was, why don't we take what the pathologists use and change it in ways that we can use it in living people? So that's what Pittsburgh Compound B is.
And it basically allows you to see Alzheimer's in the brains of living patients, which is something we couldn't do before, right?
Before that, yeah, we could not.
You tested many members of the DeMoe family for the mutation that would assure that they would develop Alzheimer's at a relatively young age. And for the most part, you wanted to tell them in person. So they would fly out from North Dakota or Wyoming or Colorado or wherever they were at the time, and you would deliver the news in person. Why?
Well, you know, that's just a standard part of genetic counseling. You don't call someone up and leave a voicemail saying you have a mutation that will guarantee you'll die from Alzheimer's disease when you're in your late 40s or 50s, you know. So that's pretty obvious. But, you know, it's a whole process. It's not just telling them what the results of the tests were. We first sit down with them at this same table and talk about whether they really want to get the test. You know, and we try to bring up things that they may not think about. You know, it may have this implication. What about long-term care insurance? What about, you know, discrimination, even though there's this Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA? What about this? What about that? What about having kids? What if you're negative? You know, that doesn't come without feelings also. And we try to have them sort of, let's say, think through a day believing that you're positive, and then think through a day believing that you're negative. And yeah, you're telling us you want the test today, and we'll draw the blood, and we'll get the test results back. But before you want it, you'll get another chance to say yes or no, I want these test results back. And then we impart the information, be it happy or sad, And then we talk about what that means for the person. And it's a whole process. It's not just sitting down and telling them face-to-face. And some things happen face-to-face, but some of the follow-up things, you know, happen via all of the communication styles we have today.
Dr. Klunk mentioned that there are emotions that come with finding out you don't have the mutation as well. And in the family that you looked at, I guess, sort of third generation that we knew of that was at risk for this, there was Wanda DeMoe, and then there was Galen DeMoe, and then their six children. Only one of those six children tested negative for the mutation. Can you talk about Carla, what role she played in that family, and what she went through, sort of becoming the caregiver to all of her siblings?
You know, I thought Carla's story was one of the more interesting transformations that happened in that family. Before she learned that she was the only one that didn't have it, she was a very different person. She wasn't as close to her siblings, I think, as she later became. She was very timid. And when she had this responsibility kind of thrust upon her, it completely transformed her. It made her a much stronger person. But at the same time, that burden is huge. As you can imagine, she feels a great responsibility to make sure that her siblings have the care that they deserve and the support that they deserve. And she is the go-to person for multiple generations now in terms of figuring out all kinds of things, from entering research studies to when it's time to take somebody's keys away.
This question is sort of for both of you, I guess. What was it like to get to know this family, to meet so many members of this family, and to become so intertwined in their lives? Let me start with you, Dr. Klunk.
Well, I think Nikki said it best that, you know, these families are rare, but the DeMoes are rare among the rare. So just, you know, there's the disease and then there's the people with it. The disease itself is compelling. You know, all of us who are as old as I am, I remember the first time you meet someone with Alzheimer's disease that's younger than you. And that happens pretty quick if you work with people with early onset disease. So, you know, seeing people in a stage of life when they're raising children and working actively, the disease is an entirely different animal, even though it's still terrible when it's typical late onset form. Those folks often have grown children to be taking care of them rather than worrying about what's going to happen to my teenager when I become demented. So on that level, the disease itself is captivating. But Nikki said it earlier, these are just such pure and genuine people who welcome you into their family and make you feel like they're a part of it. And, you know, you can't help but be around them and have your own professional demeanor break down and become the person you are, you know. And it's very refreshing. And they're just a nice group of people who everybody likes to be around. And that's not because of the disease. That was the case before anybody ever knew what this disease was.
Nikki, you wrote in the book that Dr. Klunk would not want to go to, what was it? Maybe I'm not getting it right.
Typically you don't go to dinner, I think, with people who don't know their status, just so that you don't accidentally give away anything one way or the other. Yeah.
But you would go to dinner with the ones who already knew or the ones who are already diagnosed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine sitting here, or over a dinner table with somebody who decided they didn't want to know whether or not they carried the mutation, but you knew that? That's a stressful situation that I wouldn't want to put either side in. So, because, you know, they read everything that you do and you read everything that they do in response to what you do and back and forth. So.
You know, as I was reading the book, there was a lot of moments that sort of choked me up. When you were writing this book, when you were sort of intertwined in this family, did it feel as tragic in the moment as it sometimes feels as a reader reading this story?
Absolutely. You know, I worked on this book for 5 years, and when I first started it, you try to be detached because as a journalist, that's what you're trained to do. And it's impossible to spend this much time with people like this who are going through this situation, who are willing to tell you every detail about their lives and not be impacted by it. You cannot do it and keep them at arm's length. So yes, there were times when the book went through several revisions, which is all part of the process, and there were certain points where even on the sixth time I rewrote something, I had to stop because I was crying. And that's literally never happened to me as a journalist, ever.
This might be something you both have thought about, or maybe not. Would you want to know? Would you want to take the test and know if you were in their shoes?
Well, what I tell people is what I believe, and that's I would want to know if the answer made a difference to a decision I needed to make. If it didn't, given the lack of curative treatments we have now, and certainly, you know, in the very early ages, you know, people sometimes ask, well, should we genotype a child at birth? And no. You know, I think a child deserves to live free from as much knowledge of that as they can avoid until they can't avoid it, given the current circumstances. But yeah, if I was, you know, whatever the decision was, the most obvious is having children. But, you know, there are many other decisions where that would impact. So in those cases, yes. Otherwise, no.
Did you think about this, Nikki?
Yeah, actually, when I first started working on it, I was of the mind that I would want to know. I was actually pretty certain about that. But the longer I spent with people who were finding out or who were living with the news one way or the other, I actually ended up changing my mind about that. Because what I learned from this family was the power of living in the moment and appreciating your life for what it is and not for what you think it's going to be 10 years from now. Which ended up being actually a great gift that they gave me. We all have something going on in our gene pool. These people just happen to have the opportunity to know. And there's a lot of value in not knowing that until, as Dr. Klunk mentioned, you know, you need to for one reason or another.
President Obama's administration released the National Alzheimer's Plan in 2012 with a goal of finding a way to prevent and effectively treat the disease by 2025, and we're now just 8 years away from that. Do you think that's likely to happen, and do you have any idea what might happen to federal funding for Alzheimer's research under President Trump?
You know, the currently proposed budget includes a cut for the National Institutes and Health and all the research that occurs there. How that will apply specifically to Alzheimer's disease, I don't know. But in order to get from where we are to where we need to be from 2025, we need more funding than we have today. We need to attract new young people to the field. We need to attract senior investigators who work on related fields but don't concentrate on Alzheimer's disease. We need to be able to fund bigger studies that are large enough to definitively answer the questions that we need to ask. There are many groups and agencies, such as the National Alzheimer's Association, working hard to increase the budgets. We've gotten very promising increases over the past couple of years. Those have been proposed for the current year and going forward to get to the $2 billion recommended by NAPA. But I think there's risk that that won't happen given the budget that we've recently seen.
Can you talk about sort of, I guess, where we are now? What are the latest discoveries in Alzheimer's research?
Well, I think, you know, we're fine-tuning our approach to the amyloid hypothesis that has been the driving force and what's a lot behind this focus on these early onset cases that sometimes have mutations on this gene. It's called the amyloid precursor Pittsburgh compound B images amyloid in the brain. It's a protein deposit. And we think that's an integral early step, not the only one by any means. We've targeted drug discovery programs at this protein that have had equally poor success as any other drug over the past decade or more. But we're understanding that to apply that after the disease has started is too late, and not to apply it aggressively enough is probably not going to do it. So there are ongoing studies that have given us hints that if we decrease amyloid in the brain, we can perhaps stem the progression of the cognitive / memory / functional impairments. And those trials have expanded from small studies to large studies, and we're anxious to see what that will show us. The dominantly inherited Alzheimer's network that this family is a part of, and many others are around the world, do very similar things in this well-defined population. We've expanded our knowledge of biomarkers, which are changes in the body that can be studied before any symptoms are present, to include other proteins. The second important protein besides amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's is called neurofibrillary tangles that are made out of a different protein called tau. And now we can image tau in the brain, and there are programs underway to target tau therapeutically. And there are other targets as well. But as most diseases, particularly in the early stages, probably no one of these will be optimal. You know, this is a universally fatal disease. No one has survived Alzheimer's disease. We need to find that first survivor, and that probably is going to take a cocktail of several different drugs. And we're still working hard to find the first really effective disease-modifying drug.
So is 2025 doable in your mind?
Yeah, but we better hadn't waste much time.
Nikki Capsimbelis, Dr. Bill Klunk, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. William Klunk is co-director of the Alzheimer's Research Center at the University of Pittsburgh. His work is detailed in the new book, The Inheritance, by Pittsburgh-based author Nikki Capsimbelis.